like there's a lot of, you know, organized stupidity actually in the research community when it comes on how we collaborate and how we try to make our knowledge accessible even to colleagues that are very close to us.
Benedikt Vegger is my sparring partner in this new episode of Exploring Digital Spheres. Since 2017, Vegger has headed the Learning, Knowledge and Innovation Research Program at The Hague. We speak about the creation of new knowledge at universities, how essential they are to the way we do research, but that researchers often don't find the time to do what they do best.
The typical academic career path takes people away from doing research at the point where they're the best.
Vegger pleads for thinking differently on what research actually is and how to creatively share its findings within our societies. Here is our conversation.
Would you say you have a different way of getting to The Hague than most people that study here?
Like there are different kinds of people at The Hague, as you probably have got to know during your podcast sessions as well. Like there are those who have been here for a very long time. There are still a few that also studied here as PhDs who also have, like leading roles now. And there are also, of course, people that are here for a shorter period of time, you know, visiting researchers, associate researchers. And those are actually incredibly important because they kind of stay part of the broader family. And of course, we have a lot of students as well. Also, those people usually stay for a long time because they like it here and they can, as far as I can see it, work on more or on better topics than they could do perhaps in other research institutions. So it's a lot of different kind of roles that are here and people that are fluctuating, but of course, always some kind of core team that remained over all these years. And I think this is part of the strength of the Hague.
Maybe as a little bit of an introduction, I was reading on the Hague website your little bio, and there were things that I did understand, like, for example, that you are dealing with questions concerning the governance of science and innovation. What I didn't understand is the sentence that follows that, in particular with the topics of impact and third mission.
Well, maybe it's better if I even go a step further back. So in the program that I am heading, we actually have three pillars. So we look at how knowledge is created, how knowledge is organized, and how knowledge is disseminated. So this is the inner, like the first pillar, the inner scientific perspective. Here we do, for example, studies on how researchers share their data, like what motivates them to replicate. Then we have the second pillar where we look at how research is organized. So we look at, for example, how the institutions for knowledge, basically universities and research institutes, are equipped for doing research for the 21st century, basically meaning like what kind of knowledge do they produce, how for the problems that we are facing today. And the third pillar, which is on the relation between science and society. And here I think the term third mission and the term impact relates to, because we look at how you actually could define societal impact and how you could measure it. So basically the first mission of academia is research, the second mission of academia is teaching, and the third mission is a bit of a newer term, the relation between science and society. And when people talk about third mission, they usually mean the kind of knowledge transfer that happens from universities to society.
You were saying at some point you're doing or you're focusing on researchers within academia. Could you maybe talk a little bit about the role that universities play in all of this? I can understand that maybe universities, they're this context or this to provide this shelter for these research to do research. What would you say is the role of universities in the sharing of knowledge between researchers as well?
Well, I mean, like universities are incredibly important institutions, and I mean they are highly regarded and important for many different reasons. They have been there for forever. They become bigger because we get more students, of course, and more money is put into research, and of course also, universities have an important role for a modern knowledge society, because they, of course, they educate, you know, future workers, and they produce knowledge that should be applicable in different societal spheres. But at the same time, they are, of course, very old institutions that, well, this is my personal opinion, come very close to, often very close to, like, what Weber, Max Weber described as a bureaucratic organization. Like, it's somehow, like, even ironic how, you know, the organization of knowledge is represented in universities, and you wonder if this is the best way to organize knowledge in the 21st century. Just like one example, you have this faculty structure. Like, how often does it happen that one researcher works together with a researcher from another faculty? Like, that is basically doesn't happen, and you wonder, like, why is it not happening? Because of course, the people that sit on the chairs want their people together. So it's basically a lot of different single units that are very specialized in particular areas and are prevented by design to talk to each other. If you go to university, you often even don't find a coffee machine that would make it possible for people to you know, talk about their research over a coffee. Like, it's a it's very fascinating. Also the way how careers at universities happen. You know, maybe you're talented PhD, then you are a successful postdoc, you know, you publish a lot, you're able to get funding from renowned funding organizations, like in Germany, DFG, for example, like the German Research Association or the BMBF, whatever. Like, but you accumulate funding and resources, you basically, and then perhaps you become a professor, but then as a professor and you showed that you are, you know, a very good researcher, then suddenly you are a science manager and you're not able to do research anymore. But you are perhaps involved in 15 different projects where you cannot actually do a meaningful contribution. You're responsible for 20 PhD students and actually believe this is something that is worth having. You know, it's interesting how actually this the typical academic career path takes people away from doing research one at the point where they're the best. It's a, I think it's called Peter Principle. Have you heard about this? Like, you, that you, you know, you're, you climb higher the career level until the level of incompetence, where you then remain. And this is like, if I'm a bit nasty, could be the typical description of a professor career. Of course, that's not the case, but I mean, not always the case. But the logic is a bit like the same as if you would, you know, you would be Messi, and suddenly Barcelona would decide, yeah, we, I don't know what the coach is named, Valverde or whatever, like they would decide to replace him with Messi because Messi is the best football player. You know, it's, you know, taking the best athletes out of the game in order to, you know, manage the game. Doesn't make any sense.
Now, of course, you're looking at these institutions, like, for example, universities. You're looking at how relevant information comes across, how it is has a societal impact. What would you say is sort of the research of the future, let's say it like that? Do you have any idea how ideal research looks like, or what is a more relevant approach to doing research?
Well, I myself do not have a really normative approach towards it. Like, I think there are like different kinds of research, and then like all different kinds of research should have their freedom to do what they want to do. For example, it's like I don't think that base research should be applied. Like, you shouldn't ask a base researcher to you know, to work on a society, like a problem that is relevant for society. Nobody asked for a computer, for example, but so did nobody for the nuclear weapons, by the way. Also an example for a societal impact that base research had. But what I try to say is, like, there should be freedom to do whatever you want to do. But like, we should make it possible for serendipity to happen. So if we say, for example, you know, like a lot of things that happen in base research, so like with base research, I mean research that basically is conducted within disciplines or only within science. But what we have a lot here is unnecessary boundary work. So, for example, an institute says, or often also research communities, you have to publish in this six journals. otherwise it's not important. You know, this happens a lot. It's very common. It's very common for institutes and universities, faculties to have these sort of journalists. And there are many different other phenomena for this as well. But it's just think about what happens if you have one of these journalists. If I was, for example, an economist and I would publish in a top psychology journal, you know, I would be in a way, you know, super relevant or super excellent because I actually succeeded in, you know, contributing relevant knowledge in a related field. But this wouldn't count into my, you know, like into my recognition or in that kind of recognition that is important for me to go one step higher.
As an economist.
As an economist, yeah. So like it's one thing, and it happens a lot if you look at how, you know, how politicians and also science managers argue. Like, it's one thing to say you have to work interdisciplinary, but it's another thing to prevent it by stupid design decisions such as journalists, for example. And you find that a lot, especially in the social sciences. Like every single research field tries to imitate being a discipline. So I studied, for example, I studied economics and communication science in my bachelor, and then I went on to study organization science. But communication science, which I still refer to a lot by the ways I look at things and then the methods that I use, the communication scientists don't talk to the media scientists, even though they look at the same at the same problems. It's just I'm not sure what it is, if it's ignorance or arrogance or but they pretend to do different things. The same holds true if I look at like the disciplines that I'm now relating to, for example, those people that do higher education research and you know, science communication or science research. Like those are also two different communities, and they publish in their own journals, and they have their own professorships. Like there's a lot of, you know, organized stupidity actually in the research community when it comes on how we collaborate and how we try to make our knowledge accessible even to colleagues that are very close to us.
Would you see a research group or development in researchers outside of academia, outside of universities, come into existence?
You mean if like there are meaningful collaborations between, let's say, institutionalized researchers? And yeah, of course. I mean, like, of course, this is all a gray zone. Like, it's like there is nothing like a pure base research and pure applied research. But there are highly skilled people, of course, in non-research related or non-academic fields. Like there are, of course, data scientists that are much more equipped than most of the data scientists in research that work at Google or Facebook. Like one example, or economists at the World Bank or whatever. And this is just like, if you think about, let's say deep research or research that is on a very high level, but also on a, let's say, a bit of a lower entry level, like in this whole citizen science projects, for example, like that are also projects where, outsiders work together with researchers. In a way, this is also a good way for, science communication, because what could be a better way to communicate with people than involving people in an actual research project? So I think there are a lot of bridges between productive bridges between science and society, both on an expert level as well as on a lay level.
We've, I think, talked quite a bit about one or two specific topics. Is there anything we sort of missed but that you'd like to sort of talk a little bit about in terms of your research?
Well, we could talk about the an essay competition that we started last year called that was something a bit, you know, unrelated to the things we usually do, but it still has some, like, you know, some founding in our research program. So we did a research, essay competition, started last year. It's still ongoing, called 2040, where we actually asked researchers to imagine utopias for a digital society. So we mapped it onto five categories. So the future of work, the future of love, like with love also interpersonal relationships, the future of living, how do we live in cities, but also in apartments, whatever, the future, like rule, like how are, you know, governmental relations? How is regulatory things going on? How do countries work together? And one that I'm all, learn, of course. Like, how do we learn and how do we create knowledge in future? So these five we had, and we like put it out there, and more than 100 people applied for it. Actually, also like very good researchers wanted to take part in this, what I think is a science communication experiment. Because usually we as researchers are good in, you know, making sense of the past, criticizing the present, but we don't think much about the future. It's something that is a bit, you know, some would even say unscientific, but I think it's not unscientific, by the way. Like, if you look at big science philosophers like Karl Popper, for example, who, you know, is the father of critical rationalism and falsificationism, like, he basically says, like, you always have to be skeptical about what is there. This is the idea of cumulative research, right? Being skeptical of what is there. Also, you know, like putting that kind of knowledge away from the pile of knowledge that we refer to that is perhaps false. But you could actually also apply this kind of critical rationalism to the future. So why not develop utopias and then asking why they could not work? So this is why I think it's a valuable trait for science as well, and not just for like future researchers. Like there's a stream called future studies or something. I don't think this needs to be a discipline. This could be a method in many disciplines. Anyway, so we did this essay competition, and then, but we only asked for extended abstracts. We then invited them to Berlin. And the first thing we went out to the countryside where we stayed for 5 days, and we had different coaches there. And it, for them, it was like a very, you know, unusual experience. Like they were like, they could just focus on working. Like no emails, nothing else. There were just like, there were no disturbances, and we tried to make it as easy for them as possible. We had coaches. I thought a bit about that, like, you know, what's it called? The ghost of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future. So we had three different kind of coaches that were all there for different parts of the stories they produced. So we had one that was like very focused on creativity and destroying the idea that they had first, and try to reformatting it in a new format. And then we had another one that was just helping them on producing text quickly. So it was like a very colorful experience for them. Which is also interesting, because in the end, and now like we have all the essays, we're now doing the proofreading, like this is where we are at the moment. We're trying to reach out to partners that could help us, you know, making more than just, because we want to do an edited volume that is open access. But I think like we shouldn't stop at the edited volume. Like we should think about what could be good ways to build upon the edited volume. So for example, have open educational resources, because you can make a nice lecture out of it. You can make an exhibition out of it, you know, all these kinds. So at the moment, like we have an illustrator doing nice illustrations for the chapters. We are doing the proofreading, and we try to reach out to perhaps find partners to do a bit more than just the edited volume. But what I found funny is, like, due to this whole process, like this whole you know, moderated process, but also the, of course, the experience in the countryside, they didn't produce essays anymore. Now they produced you know, diary entries or newspaper articles or fictional and policy briefs or email conversations, you name it. Like, they were also like very creative when it comes to the format that I chose to deliver the message that I wanted to. And of course, like, this is nothing that every researcher needs to do, and but I found it like a very like, you know, a very enriching experience to just have something like that as well, and to see that you know, that for a lot of researchers is it's also important to create a space to do meaningful work. And if we come back, for example, to this idea of a university, like often the space for meaningful work to happen is not there. Like, you have all these useless reporting, planning, accountability apparatus. Like, we need to create space for creative people to work on meaningful things. And I think perhaps this is the ideal of research that you were asking me a bit before.
That was Benedikt Vecher talking about pushing the boundaries of knowledge creation. If you want to know more about his research, click on the links in the show notes. And as always, for more information on the Alexander von Humboldt Institute for Internet and Society, their research and future events, go to hiig.de. In our next episode, Hig researcher Thomas Bechle speaks with Frank Sauer on LAWS, Legal Automated Weapon Systems. Ladies and gentlemen, if you learned something today, if you're 20 minutes wiser about the internet, then do leave us a comment or rating on iTunes. This was Exploring Digital Spheres. Catch you on the flip side.